Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order January 23rd, 2019. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Schauer, Senator Wilikowski. We've been joined in the room by Senate President Geisel, Senator Birch, Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, Senator Hughes, and we have a few strays from down the hall, Representative Wilson, Representative Tilson, Representative Johnson, and
Vance.
And Rep. LeBon. And Vance. So welcome everybody to Senate Finance. And today we're going to have two presentations. We're going to start with the OMB director, and then we're going to go on to legislative finance. These will be preliminary overviews of the upcoming budget, which the revenue designee mentioned yesterday will be dropped on the 13th of February. So we're starting our preliminary work on that. There'll be a presentation and discussion today on more on the process versus the numerics of the budget. So we're going to just lay some groundwork down. I think it'll be interesting for the legislature and the public to kind of see the thought process behind the budget, because the budget might take the air out of most of the rooms it's dropped into. With that, I'd like to go ahead and invite the OMB director forward, please. And if she can introduce herself for the record, who she represents, and maybe start at the start of your presentation, because you're new to the committee and a lot of the public is in your current position, to give us a brief background of who you are and that sort of stuff, and then we'll let you go through your presentation, and we'll also, if you want a lifeline on any particular questions or anything, I see you have staff here, feel free to have those staff people assist you, so we have accurate answers to the best of OMB's ability. And if we have questions that you're uncomfortable answering, that is fine. You can either get back to the committee, or they may be of such a nature that you want to have the budget dropped first on the 13th before you answer those questions. I'll leave that up to you. Go ahead and start your. Can you pull the mic in real tight so we can?
Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned, on February 13th, we will be presenting the governor's proposed budget for fiscal year 20. This morning, as you mentioned, I'm presenting the processes that we're employing in order to build a balanced budget for the next fiscal year. We began on day one of the administration. We started with eliminating budget silos, tearing down the silos.
Could we maybe stop there before we drop into the detail and maybe give the public a synopsis of your background and, you know, kind of who you are, just kind of fill it in, because we haven't had that opportunity yet, and it would be good for the public to know that you have some background in the subject matter in which you're about to present.
I've served 7 different governors. This will be the 7th in 6 states. So I've been doing this quite some time. And as a budget director or a deputy director, I worked once in the legislature for the Speaker of the House in Florida. And so I appreciate your welcoming me here today.
Do you have any background with any organizations outside of OMB director's duties you've had, or Arthur Laffer, ring a bell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Prior to working for states on budgets, I worked in investment banking. And then after I semi-retired from state service, public service, I started an economic consulting firm with Dr. Arthur Laffer, who was Ronald Reagan's economist, as well as Steve Moore, also a prominent economist in Washington.
So you've been doing this quite some time, for a few decades, is that correct?
A few decades, yes, I'm old.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, go ahead and continue your presentation, please.
So the first thing that we did, as you're aware, is bring the administrative services directors into the Office of Management and Budget. We did so in order to collaborate better with the agencies and across agencies. We immediately began to identify redundancies. As we did so, we started establishing policy teams across departments. We're going to continue to do so. So every time that we find something crosses more than one agency, we put together a policy team. So there's just a couple of examples here. There are boards and commissions across agencies, regulations across agencies. Several agencies are involved in healthcare. And as you know, we have numerous state assets around state government. So those are just examples of the policy teams that we have created and continue to work across departments. Next thing we did was define the problem. This may look familiar. On December 14th, we issued this fiscal summary along with the governor's preliminary fiscal year 20 budget. On that date, this fiscal summary served for us to define the problem. We started with the Department of Revenue's updated revenue summary book, adding to that the revenues from that, adding to that the statutory earnings reserve calculation, which brought us to an unrestricted general fund revenue total of about $3.2 billion. Using also the previous administration's November 30th proposed spending plan, come up with, as you saw and as you can see here, about a $1.6 billion unrestricted general fund deficit, which we considered the starting place. You may also notice that we began to streamline the fiscal summary. The amount of line items are condensed. The information still exists, and you may have it. It's just that for the general public, we think it's much easier to see that there's a revenue line, there are expenditure lines, and we come to a bottom line, which is simply a deficit or a surplus. Then the next question, of course, is where is the money going? And you're accustomed to, I believe, the blue line chart you see here. But we wanted to make sure that we were capturing everything that's going out of the state treasury. So the first thing we did was added designated general funds, which you know as DGF, to UGF and said all money is green. If it's going through the state treasury, the legislature should be able to review and analyze it. And so let's add DGF to our analysis. So a better bar chart than the one that just has the blue bars is let's take a look at everything we're spending money on, regardless of the funding source. In addition to that, the Alaska Constitution does not allow, as you know, for designated funds. We consider state spending, all spending is state spending, so all programs should compete for available dollars. So let's scrutinize those programs that are funded with designated general funds, because all money is green, and it belongs to Alaskans. So we just gave you some examples of designated funds. You know that there are numerous others. The blue chart shows that as a percentage of the general fund budget, designated general funds have actually been increasing over the years.
Before you go on to that next slide, slide number five, I think on the first line where it says Alaska Constitution does not allow designated funds, that word should be dedicated funds.
Chairman, thank you.
Senator Machicki, and then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Quite a difference on the percentage between FY14 and FY18. To what do you attribute that, 80% increase from 10% to 18% on designated funds?
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
We'll get back with you with the breakdown of the point of this analysis to show that it's no longer a sliver of the budget and it continues to grow. And therefore, portion of the budget that has remained relatively unscrutinized is growing and shouldn't be off the table.
We've had some discussions with the OMB director on this to keep the fund, to fund general fund sources separate, but to analyze both of them and then put them both together in the end if we want, but not to put all our concentration in one and ignore the other. So we'll be looking at everything, and then there'll be probably some work coming over the interim on fund designations. Senator Von Imhoff. Okay, go ahead and continue. Oh, just a second, you have a follow-up?
Well, I think it's largely a function of the reduction in the UGF budget itself, right? But I'd just like to know that there, if that is the constant, so I can stand by and wait for that.
Go ahead and continue.
In addition to that, and this is a continuing project for ours, as we say, there's a lot of different colors of money coming into the state. In our opinion, all money is green. So we wanted to illustrate for you and for the governor that there are receipts and revenues coming in from a number of sources, but they really all go to the same place and therefore should all be scrutinized. We've also been building the budget with a set of guiding principles. You've heard the governor talk about revenues and expenditures should be equal. And by this, we mean that our expenditures should not exceed statutorily available revenues. Another of our guiding principles is to maintain reserves. Guiding principles include department missions should drive the department programs, that if we need to change statutes or regulation to reform or reduce or eliminate programs, that we will propose to do so, that we're not going to propose continuing to squeeze budgets and tell everybody in the departments to keep doing what they're doing with a lot less money. We recognize that if we need to stop doing something, we should eliminate it in statute or regulation. Our proposals are all policy driven. And as I said, rather than asking agencies to do more with less, we're asking them to do less with less in many instances.
Okay, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So thank you for this, and I actually appreciate the guiding principles. The second to last bullet is policy-driven proposals, and then you have department missions to drive department programs. How does data might fit into that in terms of driving policy, driving programs, driving resource allocation?
Through the chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
I appreciate the question. I'm going to be talking about it in one of these slides, because as we progress through policy-driven proposals, then data is absolutely a requirement for us. Thank you. So to continue on with the policy-driven approach.
Hold on, we have one more question from Senator Bishop.
Good morning and welcome to the Finance Committee. You just talked about doing less with less at the departments. How's that weighted per department? Because I'm very sensitive to Alaska Higher Workforce Development and Training, and I listened to the governor's speech last night, and he's big on Alaska Higher as well. And are you going to shut down workforce development, which is a critical mission to the state, just because your revenues are down there?
Through the chair.
Right.
Our detailed proposals will be available on February 13th. That being said, this discussion of a policy-driven approach is what we've used with our agencies. We did not give them an across-the-board cut number. We didn't give them numbers to start with. We said, let's take a policy-driven approach. I'm going to start taking you through sort of the top-down approach that we used with them so that we could determine which policies are, which programs are priorities, which are core services, aligning their core services, eliminating duplications, and I'll be taking you through that approach as we go through the slides.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had a few commissioners and people higher up in the administration come by my office, and when I've asked them about how the budget cuts are being coming about, they've generally deferred to you. And I'm just curious how that process is working. Are the cuts coming from the commissioners and from the administration, or are you proposing the cuts?
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
Senator, good questions. And I believe the commissioners have been consistently describing our process, which is bringing the administrative service directors to OMB has allowed us to compile a budget within the OMB and not strictly leave it up to the agencies to do. But we have been working with the agencies. As I will take you through this, you will see that we've been working through all of their programs with them. As I said, identifying the core programs, prioritizing their core programs, in some cases finding things that really agencies are doing now that aren't part of their core missions or even fit within their primary business processes. So we've been working through the agencies on a program basis, and also, of course, trying to find efficiencies within those programs, but really taking a policy-driven approach. In the final analysis, though, OMB has compiled and is compiling the budget that you will see on February 13th with input from the agencies, but it was not, as in the past, put together solely by the agencies.
Any follow-up question, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. And I guess I have a little bit of concern about that. We have commissioners who are selected by the governor, approved by the legislature. You are not approved by the legislature. You've been in Alaska for about a month, 6 weeks. I know you're planning on leaving Alaska in probably the next few months after we're done here. So I guess I'm concerned about so much power focused and budget creating ability placed in your hands. Would a commissioner, if they disagreed with your cuts or proposals, would they have the ability to say, hey, I think that's going to hurt my mission in my department, or do you have the final say over that?
Would.
The chair. So I work for the governor. I am part of the governor's office, and all decisions go through the governor, as do the commissioners. And we absolutely work with the commissioners, and they absolutely have a say. They're driving their programs, they're driving their core services, and we've been working very well with them to align them in their core processes so they can focus on those things that you most want them to focus on and that we need them to be doing.
Okay, go ahead and continue. Wait a second, we got Senator Olson, I guess, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for coming in this morning. I hope you don't look at us as hostile toward what's going on. We're just trying to brace ourselves for what's going to be happening, because the last thing we want to see is, you know, the weeping and gnashing of teeth and rioting in the streets. But as you look at it, and I'm not saying that you're going to be, and I'm not highlighting your tenure here or that you're going to be leaving after a while, but what's your receptivity to supplemental budgets that are going to be dealing with after the cycle has started? Are you open to that? Or?
You can answer that.
Thank you. So if the question is supplemental budgets after the fiscal year 20 budget, because to be clear, we will be proposing a supplemental budget for fiscal year 19. Okay. But it is not our intention to build a budget that will require you to return mm-hmm. for a supplemental budget in fiscal year 20.
Sure. That's my question. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
And with that, let me just add, for those watching at home, a supplemental budget is normally done in the outside of the future year's budget to basically fix the current year's issues that may arise, and it could be forest fires, it could be earthquakes, it could be budgetary errors and omissions, or unplanned for events. And I've talked with the OMB director and expressed our desire that whatever budget we have at the table is not directed to have a supplemental a year from now. So we're basically having a bunch of pretend numbers in front of us looking like we're actually reducing a budget or responding to a program, when in fact we're just going to have the bill put on our desk next January. So we're going to keep an eye on that and work with the OMB director to ensure that we have the smallest supplemental budget possible coming next year, Also, on their budget submission, we've encouraged them to have their statutory language to allow the implementation of those reductions put in and into the legislative system. So we don't remove funds for the budget that are statutorily required the governor to implement, and they get either implemented voluntarily or involuntarily through the courts, and we get the bill anyway. So we've asked the OMB director to give us a breakdown of and a list of statutory structural changes that will be needed to implement the budget. So they're working on that, and I'm hoping to have that delivered on the day of the budget, the 13th. Senator Michicki.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you're experienced in other states, because you've probably run up against the kind of issues we're going to face, particularly health and social services, federal Medicaid requirements, federal SNAP requirements. I mean, that's just an obstacle that we've been looking at for years. In the other states where you've been able to successfully deliver reductions, what kind of tension is there between the federal requirements and what you're able to do with state statute to make those reductions?
Through the chair. Thank you, Senator. And in many states, as you're aware, have been able to work with the federal government to receive waivers, and particularly Medicaid, in order to implement programs that are more efficient and are more tailored to serving a particular state's needs. So I would anticipate that we would be pursuing the same here in Alaska.
Okay. Forward.
So the maintenance of effort is always a challenge on SNAP programs and things like that. Have you had similar successes with the other public assistance programs as well?
Can you define SNAP for the public, please?
Food stamps, if you will, for the public.
Through the chair. So every state has different challenges, Senator. Maintenance of effort is maybe more of a challenge here than it is in other states, but it is also one of the items on our discussion list for the commissioner and the administration's talks with the federal government. So I believe that we will be seeking waivers that include maintenance of effort in some cases.
Okay, go ahead and continue, please.
Oops. So our policy-driven approach includes, and I've got four slides following this, that show consistent policies across state government, as I've mentioned before, core services alignment, program prioritization, and then as the Senator Von Imhoff noted, metrics, outcomes, and best practices. Starting with consistent policies. So there's just examples of consistent policies that we're employing across state government. For example, reducing dependence, business process realignment, returning maximum return on assets, reducing regulatory burdens, eliminating non-essential programs. Core services alignment. We asked all of our agencies We asked all of our agencies to start with a core services alignment. Illustrated here is Department of Environmental Conservation. We use them as an example because it's easy to see here on this slide, and they did a good job with it. It seems simple, but it's very, very important for any business or any state agency to analyze what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what their most important priorities are. So you can see, for example, that for the Department of Environmental Conservation, their core services and priority order include protecting human health, then protecting the environment. And then, like many agencies, they also had things that didn't fall into their core services at all. So it was a good place for us to begin the analysis.
And Senator Wilkowski has a question, then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could get you to go back to slide 9, and if you could define for me just some of the terms on here. Well, a couple of questions. Number one, outsourcing, if you could talk about where you're looking at outsourcing. The second question would be non-essential programs, if you could define that. And then what areas do you believe we should have more user pay?
Through the chair?
Right.
Senator, so our proposals in specifics will be available on February 13th. There are opportunities across state government for all of these items, including outsourcing. What this slide describes is that we believe that we should have consistent policies throughout state government. So, for example, on user pay, because we're not allowed to have dedicated funds in Alaska, are we going to, as a policy, these are questions that I believe y'all should be asking as well, are we going to, as a policy, have user revenues match expenditures for those programs that are very specific to a group of users? And some of our agencies were asking, if there's a program that's a low priority program, should we be working with our user groups to determine whether or not they would rather pay for those services than see them dropped from the state?
Okay, go ahead and continue. We have a next question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So again, also on slide 9, third bullet, unleashing entrepreneurialism. I like hearing that, but I wonder, within the current labor laws with our contract or their unions, can we offer things that you hear in entrepreneurialism, say that well? Offer merit pay, sidestep seniority, allow job sharing, work from home, offer innovation rewards. The private sector does engage in a lot of these activities with employees, but can we do that within the confines of state government and union contracts that sometimes are just a little bit more rigid and a little bit more confining?
Through the chair. Senator, those are things that we are exploring as well, because when we talk about entrepreneurialism, there's many facets to it. One of them is we simply shouldn't be competing with the private sector. So if we're doing things at state government that compete with the private sector, then we should encourage private enterprise. To your question, we can get back to you with labor rules, but certainly would be in complete agreement that those businesses that stay within state government should also be allowed to reward those employees and departments who are achieving their outcomes.
So we look forward to, I guess, the release on the 13th with supporting documents or presentations on some of these issues. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. I have a concern about some of the user fees and having user groups. Is there a process in asking those user groups and making sure those fees, because we can't designate the funds. We had a problem with the snow machine, sort of registration user fees and those funds not being actually used for the purposes of those payers that they thought they were going to use those fees for. I just want to make sure that those fees are going to be properly identified. If you are going to try to have those user groups pay for those services and we can't do designated funds within our budget, how will that be maintained for those services?
Through the chair. So again, the details of our budget will be out February 13th. The issue here is, how are we going to, as a state, consistently treat these policies? And so I think those are questions that we're asking you. You know, as a policy, are we going to continue, or in some cases we haven't, to have user fees pay for essentially the services, or because we are a state that does not allow designated funds, is the policy of the state going to be that we don't require user fees to be consistent with those expenditures? So I put that up here as a policy question.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. You have a question? Senator Michicki, before we go on.
I want to make it clear that I am a big fan of the fact that the government should not be competing with the private sector, and also a privatization and outsourcing when possible. Research from other states have taken big swaths of their government and privatized, and often quietly within a year or two they pull some of them back in when they realize they can't be delivered at a lower cost in certain cases. My only question is, do you have a team assembled that will adequately analyze whether or not privatization is actually at a lower cost to the state?
Through the chair.
Help him with that question, not so much the comment before the question. Go ahead.
I believe the question was, are we going to have a team to analyze any of those things? And the answer, Senator, is yes.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
So we talked about core service alignment using DEC as an example, and the fact that you can see here that protecting human health is a priority over protecting environment. That doesn't mean protecting the environment's not a priority, but when you have to line them up in order, the way they lined them up was that human health came first. We went on to have them prioritize all of their programs, and as you can see, the highest priority programs were in the protecting human health area. That doesn't mean that all programs that are designed to protect human health were high priority programs. You can see over on the right-hand side that some of them were low because they're inefficient. And so we went through this exercise with all of our agencies to begin to build a budget that focuses on the core programs and those most efficient.
We have a question from Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. On the 13th, will this data be available for all departments in terms of their ranking and their priorities?
Through the chair. Senator, on the 13th, we will have the outcome of that prioritization, which will be the governor's proposed budget.
Okay. And so to follow up with that, Senator Wilson,
yeah, I guess
subcommittees could ask that question from OMB when we do our subcommittee work on prioritization. We've been struggling for years to try to get the agencies to prioritize, and a lot of times they prioritize everything as number one.
Yes, and
so follow-up question.
No, and I really do appreciate this. I've been trying for my term in the legislature to have the departments come up with their priority list, and I just appreciate this administration for taking the task on. I know it's a very difficult task for folks to pick their which programs may rank over the other programs, but I'm just glad, and I just wanted to know some of the details, and maybe that we can get that on an offline conversation. I just didn't know if that would be available for requests for legislators to ask about how the departments came with their lists and their sort of the background information.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Ardoin, you're not saying that human health is number one on the priority list, but you're not lessening the fact that the protecting the environment is also equally important. You're just showing a numbers section here.
Through the chair, certainly they're important, but I think it's important for the agencies to go through and say, if I had to prioritize, what order would I prioritize these programs? And the beginning of that was to identify that protecting us is their highest priority. That certainly does not mean, as I think you were pointing out, that they don't also have a priority in the environment. And then what you don't see on here is the things that they do that don't fall into either of those categories, which are those things that we considered the low priority programs for the agency, and that together with the agency we've identified as potential for elimination.
Okay, just a quick follow-up, just a comment. I would just say, we're going to get into this in the subcommittees, but just for today and the people that are watching at home, to me, protecting the environment and protecting human health are one and the same. They're joined at the hip. Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
So then we went on to the metric analysis. And started at a high level, but took a deep dive into all of our programs. But just as an example, and you've probably seen this chart before, total per capita spending in Alaska, state spending in Alaska, is the yellow bar, which is much higher than other states. When we go through this program by program, there are many areas where you will see that on a per capita basis, are on a per recipient basis or per user basis, Alaska outspends other states. And we started comparing across facilities or across regions. Then we started looking into outcomes. And then from there, best practices from around other states or around the world. And so these metrics, outcomes, and best practice analyses were used to finalize and will be used to finalize our budget proposals.
With that, I think the state, and we can take a look at this Kaiser Family Foundation analysis if the committee wants in more detail, but Alaska's structured a lot different than the other states in that we're the only state that owns a subsurface, and it's held in commons. We also don't have counties that have county sheriffs and courthouses and all kinds of things. So we'd have to break this analysis down to actually get a comparison, an apples-to-apples comparison. We also have a massive geographical coverage and a very sparse population and very underdeveloped in infrastructure. So it's difficult to compare us to the original 13 colonies with no federal land when we're basically owned by the federal government. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah. Does this chart calculation for Alaska include the appropriation for the permanent fund dividend? Do you know?
Through the chair, Senator, I will check with you, but it says per capita state spending. I'm going to assume that that's not included. I will tell you that on every program that we looked across state government, compared to other states, the charts generally look like this. So as we break down program by program, agency by agency, we look at our metrics across other states, we generally outspend all of them.
If we could have the OMB get back to us with a little more detail on a Kaiser analysis here so we can put it a little bit better in perspective. Senator Bishop.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just concur with your comments because I would like to see the matrix from the Kaiser Foundation and Alaska Handicapped for all the things that you just talked about so we get a true picture.
Go ahead and continue.
So finally, we're also streamlining the fiscal summary. As I pointed out on the December 14th summary we showed at the beginning, we've collapsed a number of the lines so that you clearly can see revenues, appropriations, and then whether we are in a deficit or surplus situation. In addition to that, on the governor's February 13th release, we will also be collapsing UGF with DGF, that is, unrestricted general funds with designated general funds, so that there will be one total general fund category. When we combine those general funds into one category, rather than seeing $3.2 billion in unrestricted general fund revenues available for expenditure, you will see closer to $4.2 billion in total general funds available to spend. Then you will see on February 13th our spending plan for those, and that we will not be projecting a deficit for fiscal year 20.
I would I've encouraged OMB when they do their fiscal summary to keep the classifications, and they can also the general fund classifications, they can commingle them and condense them to an easy statement like you have in front of you. But it's also nice to have the more detailed statement with footnotes. So when we take a look at OMB's opinion of the fiscal position of the state and compare that with Ledge Finance, who sometimes have minor differences, we can compare them back and forth. And we will, I think, going forward, work with OMB on potentially classifications between the two general fund categories over the interim, but it's not an issue to the time frame doesn't allow it this winter to clearly define that. But there's no intention in the Finance Committee to commingle and make those that distinction disappear between those two fund groups. We may target one general fund group for a full analysis, along then with the other one, bifurcating the two, and then reassemble them together. Otherwise, I think the complexity will get to a level in the legislature that it's going to be hard for most members to understand what's going on in the budget process. So we'll work with OMB on how they present the data. I would also like for you to note that the revenue is on the top, like most private enterprises forecast their revenue and then project their expenditures and do their budgets, where governments do their expenditures and then plug the revenue number in the bottom. So this is more along the lines, in my opinion, of how private enterprise would do a budget analysis and of their companies. And did you have a question, Senator Machicki?
I do.
And then Senator Wilikowski.
I have a question. Earlier in the slide deck, you talked about user fees in the going out to Alaskans and saying if you still support the service that you're willing to help pay for them. It sounds like, I think it's important for the public to understand that DGF could be a user fee for the university. When we make a cut to the university, goes out to their students, decides to increase their tuition, and it sounds like we may penalize that effort by collapsing them. I think it's important for the public to understand that DGF could be those user fees. Do you have a comment about ensuring that if we want to move forward with some of those services that Alaskans are willing to pay for, that we'll delineate those two types without combining them to the point of where they can no longer be determined which is which?
Can you help Senator Machicki with that?
Through the chair. The point of highlighting the designated general fund expenditures as general fund expenditures along with everything else is so that the public can see those expenditures and that they're not hidden off another page in the budget, that we will be showing and highlighting everything that is coming in, that Alaskans are paying, and that government is spending on their behalf.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your budget analysis, are you looking at all into tax credits or tax deductions that we're providing the very profitable corporations?
Through the chair. Senator, and the budget that we will be presenting on February 13th, our policy was that our expenditures should match statutory revenues, and therefore we are not proposing to change any statutory revenues.
Okay, and if I could back up for a minute on that previous question on the combining of the two general fund categories, why we'd want to look at them combined so we get a feel for the overall spend. For numerous years in the building, they're always talking about designated general funds going down, and the governors at the time talking about operating costs going, budgets going down, when in reality they were all going up, and it went on for years. And the legislature, or the sound bites in the press, was all about expenditures dropping when in fact they were going up. So by combining everything, you can't hide it. So we will, again, take both categories along with federal funds and take a look at the review and then combine them all. Because we don't want a head fake where we're talking about a direction that the budget is not going. And that went on for several governors in a row, year after year after year. So we're going to operate with as much transparency as absolutely possible here at the table, and no matter how attractive the numbers look or unattractive they look, they are what they are, and we're going to put them in the middle of the table and pull the Band-Aid off the scab and try to fix the problem before we run out of cash. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of stole my thunder on that one. I have a bit of a question, but I was curious if you might be able to just answer why in
line with what Senator Stebbins was just saying, that the UGF-only approach, when you're talking about the expenses or cuts to spending, if you believe that's a flawed approach, if you could expound a little bit on why you believe that's a flawed approach, just more your philosophy when you're looking at it.
Through the chair. Thank you, Senator, and I will. I would like to echo what the chairman said, that we would like to be more transparent, that there had been some, I would characterize as games played, moving funds back and forth to misrepresent the size of state spending in Alaska. In addition to being transparent, as stated before, we believe that all of the revenues that come into the state treasury should be available for review, and that some programs should not be treated differently than others and not have their spending scrutinized from year to year, you know, asking what they're spending the money on and what they're getting for it. We think should be applied across all expenditures and not just those that have a UGF designation.
We'll follow up, and then we're going to pretty much wrap up. I think you're done with your slide deck. Okay.
Purposely waited until the end just to make sure I wasn't asking a question she was going to answer later. Just from your experience perspective, it was mentioned before that, you know, maybe you're not from here, maybe won't be here long. Answer that if you choose. But what I'm really looking for is just maybe a little bit more on your experience, because you had mentioned you've been in, worked for several governors, several states, have used this approach. What I'm curious is just if you could give us a very brief synopsis of how successful those approaches were in solving state problems that you were brought in to help with, or failures, so that the public at home knows that this approach has something behind it. If you could just let us know how that went, so that we're, you know, is this something that may work for us?
Through the chair. Thank you, Senator. And I guess I wasn't asked the question, but I never actually stated that I wasn't planning to stay here through the process. In other states, have had incredible success working through budgets with these processes. And in order to attain a sustainable, predictable, affordable budget, which are those words in front of you on the slide, in my experience, requires a policy-driven approach, an approach wherever you're reviewing your programs, reviewing how efficient they are, reviewing their metrics, understanding the prioritization for how we spend Alaskans' money. In other states, I believe that's really the only way budgets can be sustainable, predictable, and affordable, is by continuously going through that review.
Senator Von Imhoff, this would be the last question for this presenter. We'll move on to legislative finance.
Thank you. So going back to slide five, the issue of combining UGF and DGF, I think, is okay when it comes to reporting, and to some degree to avoid the tendency that you can, that you indicated on DGF going up each year, and what Senator Stedman had mentioned, that there is money sometimes with, if maybe if general fund spending is going down, it could be propped up by DGF, which is kind of what we are finding here on slide five. But also on slide five, example of designated funds, the different taxes and the fees. And if in subsequent fees, you definitely had mentioned that we may be increasing user fees, or maybe it is going to be the university that might have to adjust their tuition if they receive less general funds. And those are real accounting are real accounting revenue that's coming in that should be tracked. And so for, if we may report them, report DGF and UGF together, but for tracking the specific accounting for DGF, that should continue and should be made available to folks on Senate Finance. When we want to drill down and maybe highlight a significant tax or user fee that may have increased as a result of changes in policy in their department, and that is real, and that's to be transparent, that needs to be available to folks that ask for it, and should be separately accounted for. So on one hand, combining them is fine, as long as it can be available when asked.
We have the ability here, as equal branches of government, to work with the governor and OMB. They don't have dictatorial control on how they're going to handle that type of information and stuff. So we'll be working with Ledge Finance and OMB and making sure we have a transparent result. So, but in her presentations, she can combine them from time to time, but we can't manage the resources of the state without separating them, in my opinion. And we should watch both columns, because one column will grow and the other one will shrink, and the press will pick up one column and not the other and don't add them up, and the public's getting a totally distorted view of what's going on. We can go back to several governors and take a look at that, in multiple sound bites. So with that, I'd like to thank the OMB director for coming. I noticed she did not ask for a lifeline, but that was good. We are now going to have Legislative Finance come forward with enthusiasm to talk about the budget issues. And we'll have a brief at ease while they get set up. The hammer drops, turn it on. Okay, we have our second presenter, Mr. Teal, with us from Legislative Finance Division. I've asked him to come forward, even though, again, it's early. We don't have a budget till the 13th. We want to lay some of the groundwork down. There may be a little different perspective from Ledge Finance, from each of us and OMB. They're, for the public watching, they're the nonpartisan arm of the legislature. And they are going to talk about the fiscal situation we're in. Mr. Teal, if you could identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and those for those watching at home that may not be familiar with yourself, maybe give us a brief synopsis of how long you've been with Ledge Finance and your roles and responsibilities there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division, and have been there about 20 years. So I'm familiar with most of you that have been around in the legislature for a while, and our job is primarily to help the legislature, that's the entire legislature, House, Senate, Majority, Minority, put together a budget. We have other duties as well, but I think that for the purposes today, that's most of it.
Okay. And your tenure, how long have you worked at Ledge Finance?
I think 20 years, okay. 21 maybe.
Okay. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, typically you invite me to appear at this table to talk about the governor's budget, but 2018 was an election year, and we've elected a new governor. And as is typical in election years or following election years, we don't have a budget on hand now. And that's, I think the public could benefit by knowing that a new governor is not given a break. There's a statutory deadline for turning in a budget on December 15th, by December 15th. That generally isn't a problem for a sitting governor. But for an incoming governor, especially one from a different party, that gives you roughly 2 weeks from inauguration to the deadline to prepare a budget. I don't think anyone really expects an incoming governor to be able to prepare a budget that reflects his policies and priorities in that short a time. So typically what happens is the governor submits a placeholder budget. That placeholder is often last year's budget. Sometimes it's the budget prepared by the outgoing governor. It doesn't really matter. The point is that you have before you a placeholder budget, not the governor's budget. The comments earlier in the committee and from indicate pretty clearly that you understand it's a placeholder budget. Now, we talked about this, the chairman and I talked about it, and said that analyzing a placeholder budget may be a waste of the committee's time. And the chairman requested that I discuss some alternative topics, specifically the fiscal summary, with emphasis on the fund source classification, and secondly, the fiscal situation. So the fiscal summary is the budget on a page, if you want to think of it that way. It's the highest level report that we produce. Some people say, if that's the simplest report you produced, I don't want to see any other reports because that's just a bunch of numbers on a page. When I say highest level, that doesn't necessarily mean the simplest. It's got a lot of information on there, and I can't argue that there's not a lot of numbers on the page, but I can point out that it's a bunch of organized numbers, and I think that makes a difference. So what you have here is we typically use a shorter version of this for internal purposes and for the chairman. In fact, frequently this fiscal summary in the short fiscal summary here is produced on a daily basis near the end of session because it's the chairman's status check on how are we lining up? What's the deficit now if we do this? We make these changes to the capital budget, whatever. He can quickly see where we are. And this longer version is produced twice a year. Once when the governor submits a budget, and then when the legislature is finished with its deliberations it's after the governor vetoes things. So it's a reference document. And as a reference document, we expect it to show the complete budget. We use it, again, as a reference document, but we don't use it on a daily basis for that purpose. Now, the most common question, I guess, is why are there so many lines and columns on this fiscal summary? And the answer there is, let's look at lines first, is that it provides detail, sub-allocations among the three main categories of expenditures. Those categories are, here's the appropriations. The first one is agency operations. That's basically the day-to-day operations of the state agencies. And you can see we break it out into Medicaid. Perhaps you can't see because I sure can't read that. And I'm not going to review these because they're so difficult to see and because I'm going to go through where we spend money in a more digestible form later. So just broad categories here. Agency operations, statewide items, which are debt service, retirement assistance, oil and gas tax credits, the kinds of things that don't have much to do with day-to-day operations of government. They're nevertheless expenditures that in some cases are very difficult to avoid You've got to pay your debt service. Retirement assistance payments are critical. And then you've got the capital budget. And they add up to total appropriations, which certainly you can summarize. But there's a tremendous loss of information when you summarize. That's particularly true of columns, of which there are many. A lot of columns because, one, we have 2 years, 19 and 20. And let's just focus on 20, and you've eliminated half of those columns. And now what's left? We've talked this morning a little bit about consolidating UGF and DGF, unrestricted general funds and designated general funds, into a single column of general funds. The OMB director believes that that's a more transparent presentation. It prevents games, and the reason for doing it is that all money is green. I disagree with that. I think you, Mr. Chairman, are more correct when you say that information is critical to making decisions. And I'll use an example here to try to explain the difference. And I guess it's why all money is not green. Let's say you give me $10 and ask me if I can go to the lounge and bring back some potato chips. Well, I can walk down to the lounge and be pretty certain that I'm going to come back with potato chips. If you give me a $10 monopoly bill and I go down to the lounge, I'm not so sure they're going to sell me chips. They probably won't, even if it has your signature on it, the thing that says, I'm the man with the top hat. But DGF is like monopoly money. It can be spent. It's authorization to spend, but that authorization to spend is worthless unless you actually collect the receipts to spend. So if you give me authorization via giving me a $10 monopoly bill, the way I convert that to real money, convert my authorization to money, is I can go around the table and collect a dollar from each committee member. Once I do that, I can walk down to the lounge and buy the chips. Now, those of you that are quick at math will look around the table and say that, well, you're not going to collect $10 because there's only 9 on the committee and one's not here at the moment, so you're only going to collect $8. And I'd say, that's the point. I can only spend $8 because that's all I collected. So authorization is not real money. It can become real money. So all money isn't green. I shouldn't say that. What I should say is all money is green, but all appropriations, all authorization is not green. And that's a big difference. So if I can't collect the money, it's just worthless authorization. Now, let's look at the other way and say, I also walk along the staff tables and collect $15 to go to lounge. I can't spend $15. You authorize me to spend $10. The other $5 cannot be spent. So that's where designated general funds differ from unrestricted general funds. Unrestricted, I can spend any time for any purpose. Designated funds, I cannot spend unless I convert it to receipts. So designated funds, good examples of those are university tuition, Senator Michikee brought up. It's the snowmobile trail receipts. It's the ticket sales for the Alaska Marine Highway. It's basically money that if you collect it, you can spend it on this. And the reason we want a separate category, designated general fund, is to prevent games. It's not that combining these into a single category prevents games. It's exactly the opposite. You can play games if you combine them. And for that, I can turn to a more real-world example. Senator Michikee talked about the university tuition. Well, he may discover that the university has $30 million in surplus tuition authorization, which is, in fact, the case. They carry it for years on their books. So they have this authorization to spend money. Now, it's DGF, of course, because it's designated for using for use by the university to provide an education to students. Well, let's say the Senate Finance Committee cuts that $30 million out of the budget. You all pat yourself on the back and say, we cut $30 million. But the truth is, you cut what we refer to as hollow authorization or uncollectible receipts. You didn't prevent the university from spending any money. You haven't changed the deficit. You haven't done anything. But it sure looks like you cut $30 million. And in our report, if we combine them, it would show a $30 million general fund reduction. Well, it's a very different thing if you were to cut $30 million worth of unrestricted general funds. That, again, is real money. And the subcommittees, the full finance committee, should be looking at what's the impact of that cut. Would it increase tuition? Would it cause the university to lose grant money because they can't match federal funds? Those are the kinds of questions that the subcommittee should be analyzing, and that if you have a combined fund source, makes it more difficult to analyze. So again, I'm all for simplification. If the simplification helps you make decisions, but your decisions are going to be a lot easier to make and better if you understand your fund sources. And just a word of warning here that it's oversimplifying those fund sources that can take you down the path of unintended consequences, and Pioneers Homes come to mind. It's the failure to distinguish unrestricted general funds from designated general funds that causes us to be in the kind of odd situation in which we have a waiting list for rooms in the Pioneers Homes while we have vacancies in the Pioneers Homes. The cause of that is, again, not understanding the difference between designated funds and unrestricted funds. So the same concept of spending is limited to the lesser of your authorization or what you can collect applies to the other sources here, the what we call other state funds. Examples of those are international airport funds, the permanent fund operating budget is one of the big ones, retirement funds. They all fall into these other because they're restricted. There are federal laws. Fish and Game Fund, for instance, is another one that federal laws or trusts or other things mean you're very limited in your ability to spend those funds on anything except what they're, in this case, dedicated to. Same with federal. As you know, federal funds often have strings attached, and I don't think federal funds need a great deal of explanation. It's money from the federal government, often to be used only for specific purposes for which you get it. So one way to look at the fiscal summary is by flexibility or discretion that the legislature has. You have very little discretion in spending federal funds. They require a match. They're for a specific purpose. You can't spend highway funds on other things. Other state funds are often the dedicated money or SDPR, which is money that we receive from, I think the legal definition is a non-state, non-federal entity that's limited by the terms of a gift, grant, or bequest, but whatever the issue, there's a contract there that says if you collect money from the Rasmussen Foundation, you have to spend it for what it's, for the reason that it's given to you. So little discretion when it comes to designated funds. There's more discretion. When it comes to unrestricted funds, there's no, it's exactly what it means. There's no limit. Any time, any purpose, any amount. Now, what that means is that if you can't spend more than you receive in federal, other, or designated funds, you cannot have a deficit in those fund categories. The only place you can have a deficit is in unrestricted general funds. And by deficit, I simply mean you're spending more than your revenue. So I think it's easy to see why we put this whole bunch of numbers on a page. It's so we can keep all this straight. I'm not so sure it helps you keep it straight, but you simply need to know the difference between the funds, how they're used, what they can be used for. If you understand that, your decisions in subcommittee will be easier and better, we hope. Now, if your focus is on seeing how much we spend in total, then you want to be looking at this version. The version, this long summary is produced in the overview, which we do every year. It's a little thin this year because there are no narratives for each agency. They are basic subcommittee documents. We can't produce them because we don't have a budget, but we do have an introduction in this document, and it talks a lot about the fiscal situation, and then the normal fiscal summary is in there as well. So if you're looking for a reference document, use this. If your focus is on balancing the budget, then this is sufficient. And again, this shows only unrestricted general funds because that's the only fund category where you can have a deficit. So what does slide 3 tell us about our fiscal situation? First thing is that in FY20, there's a deficit of $1.6 billion. May say, what's the problem? And we know that the deficit is two sides, expenditures and revenue. Which one is the problem here? Are we overspending, or do we just not have enough revenue? How can you tell the difference? So you can also see that traditional revenue, read oil revenue if you want to think of it that way, is down $400 to $500 million. That's because oil prices in 19 are expected to be about $68, and in 20 they're down to $64. You heard the forecast from the Revenue Commission last week, and I think that it's safe to assume that future years are going to look a lot like FY20 in terms of traditional revenue. Now, so you shouldn't expect any help from that source, but what about expenditures? Are they the root of the problem? Slide 4 shows revenue and expenditures over time. Now, anytime you go over a long period of time, you have to make adjustments. this goes back to 76. Well, I started with the state in 78. I made $25,000 a year and thought I was doing great. I wouldn't want to try to live on $25,000 a year now. So when you're looking at something over this long a time period, you have to adjust for inflation. You also have to adjust for a growing population because the state provides services now to twice as many people as we did in the 70s. So that's what real per capita means. It's adjusted for both population and inflation. Now, I showed this graph to a class of students. I'm sure you're all familiar with Mike Davis and the class that of university students that he brings to town. I present to them every year. It's great fun. I learn a lot. I hope they do too. They looked at this chart and said, well, they were surprised first because expenditures hadn't increased as they expected them to based on what they'd heard. You hear the same thing. Legislators spend every nickel they get their hands on. Expenditures are spun out of control. You know, we have an expenditure problem, and a big one. They looked at the chart and said, well, here we are. We're not spending any more now than we spent historically. The OMB director just showed you a chart comparing expenditures per capita in Alaska and in other states. Mr. Chairman, you raised several objections to that, good ones. And I look at it as this is a much more valuable way of comparing expenditures rather than compare to other states, which have different circumstances. We compare to what we've done in the past. I know there are a lot of people who say, why are we spending so much now? We seem to get through the 70s and the 80s just fine with that level of expenditures. Why can't we go back to that level? And it's, well, you are at that level. So expenditures actually have fallen in recent years. Much of that is in capital and statewide. And if we're looking here at the deficit, fixing the deficit, you're really not going to cut the capital budget a whole lot more, the yellow bars. The blue bars are statewide expenses, debt service that we've incurred. Also difficult to cut many of those. So often it's the operating budget itself, the dark blue bars, that are the focus of cuts. Now, what the class said was, well, we can see that expenditures have fallen in recent years and that they're historically low. But revenues per capita, real per capita revenue, fell even faster. And they are at not just near, but below historic lows. So that led the class to conclude that we don't have an expenditure problem, we've got a revenue problem. And to ask questions like why this future doesn't look very good. If revenue is expected to be about the same in the future years, this level of expenditures doesn't look good. Why isn't the legislature doing something about revenue? My response is, well, we did. Question from?
No, go ahead and continue. We'll finish your slide and then we'll come to questions.
Okay. So, actually, I think I'm finished with this slide. I was just going to go back and say that we did, in fact, address revenue. So it's probably a good time for a question if there is one.
And Senator Wilkowski, and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
I'll ask you the same question I asked the previous speaker. Is the permanent fund dividend and, I guess, inflation proofing included in this in these bars?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, Inflation is included. The permanent fund dividends are not. They're difficult to include because the fund source has changed over time, and and I think people's view of the permanent fund dividend as a government expenditure is different now than it's been in the past.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, I do have a question, Mr. Chairman. One of the interesting things is we talked, or the previous speakers talked about new eyes looking at what's going on. And let me just say that, you know, you've been around here longer than I have, and so your whole legislative finance career has been built around putting state budgets together. But so I respect what your opinions and what's out there. But did these students have any insight on what could be done for the state's fiscal situation now that has to do with the, especially with the dropping revenues?
Through the chair, they did, but I think I'll wait a couple slides to talk about that, and I have to admit I'm reluctant to talk about their conclusion because it sounds like it's my conclusion, no matter how you put it, and it borders on political statements.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, if I could continue?
Go ahead and continue.
I have one further question. I've been looking at both the slide three that the previous speaker talked about and your slide number two here, and I see roughly where you're defining the problem on the previous speaker slide as well as what we're seeing here. But as I look at the categories, the numbers seem to be $1 billion off. She's showing $4.4 billion in unrestricted general funds, and you're showing 5.5. In fact, as you play it on out, you go to 11.1 versus 10 billion, and in 2020, it's 3.2 versus 5.2, and almost $2 billion is a difference than what was presented earlier. Can you just comment on that?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Olson, the difference is that you won't see the permanent fund dividend on their fiscal summary. In their treatment, the permanent fund dividend is off budget. It shows as neither revenue nor as an expenditure. We show it as both revenue and an expenditure. So it increases revenue by $1.9 billion, and then it also increases expenditures by $1.9 billion, giving us the same deficit of $1.6 billion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then you want to go on to slide number five, I guess, in there?
Well, back to three, actually, because we were sort of in the midst here of talking about revenue and expenditures. I don't have anything to say about the expenditure line. Again, I don't think we have a budget that's worth talking about here on the expenditure side. But you can see here that on the revenue side, we are showing the dividends, and we also show them as an expenditure. So when you do that, the dividends plus the share for government adds up to $2.9 billion, which is about $200 million more than we got last year. You can also see that we're down about $200 million in revenue after considering POMV. So where we are here is that how do we get from a $300 million surplus to a $1.6 billion surplus? The numbers add up. We just have to show you where they come from. You're starting with $300 million deficit in 19, and the expenditures add $200 million to that deficit, and the loss of revenue adds another $200. So 0.3 plus 2 plus 2 is $700 million. Well, $700 million is a long way from $1.6 billion. How did we make that jump? Well, the answer is, for dividends, we spent $1 billion last year and $1.9 proposed this year. So that gives us a $900 million reduction in revenue. And that's $700 million starting point plus $900 from the dividends. So there you reach your $1.6 billion. Now, I should probably explain POMV and how it works. I think all of you know that, but there may be some who don't in the audience. SB 26 last year set up the permanent fund as sort of an endowment model. It wasn't a complete endowment. A full endowment model would have combined principal and interest. We didn't do that. We said only the earnings reserve account, that normally referred to as the ERA, can be spent. You can't dip into principal. In a regular endowment, it wouldn't matter. You can dip into principal if needed, and theoretically over the long term, you replace it. So there's no difference in those two models as long as the earnings reserve account has money in it. Then you can make your payouts, but you can't make a payout if the earnings reserve account runs out of money. That's the model we're under right now, is a separation of principal from earnings. So the legislature chose a sustainable payout rate, 5.25% at first, dropping to 5 in a year. And you can see here that without a POMV payment, the $2.9 billion, our deficit would be another $1 billion higher, because here, out of the POMV payment of 2.9, 1.9 goes to dividends, and we end up with a net gain to the general fund of $1 billion. And that's the way SB 26 reads, is you take your payout, you determine your dividends, the government gets what's left. So without POMV, our deficit would be $1 billion higher, and we would be at a $2.6 billion deficit, which is pretty comparable to the past several years. So there's no real change in our circumstances here, other than the fact that we're now using revenue from the permanent fund to reduce our dividend.
Now, Senator Schauer, you have a question?
Just a clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear on those numbers, we are not inflation-proofing off of those numbers, and we're not putting anything back into the CBR per the required payback, if you will, into the CBR. So is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, inflation-proofing is considered an intra-fund transfer. It goes from one account in the permanent fund to another account. We treat that as off-budget. So it isn't an expense. Doesn't show as revenue. Now, when it comes to the CBR, no, there is no repayment of the CBR. The Constitution requires a repayment at the end of each year, and the repayment is any excess left in the general fund or subaccounts is swept into the CBR. When we have a deficit, there's no money to be swept. In the general fund itself, there are subaccounts of the general fund. What typically happens is the legislature follows the Constitution, that money is swept, and then there's a provision in one of the appropriation bills that says reverse that sweep, put all the money back. That's for the PCE, and well, PCE isn't sweepable, but a number of sub-funds of the general fund, the money goes back into them. So no money is going to the CBR, and inflation proofing is not counted.
Go ahead and continue.
So given the sequence of events on this, where you take a payout, you pay dividends, whatever they may be, and you get to keep the rest for government expenditures, you should be able to see that the split between dividends and the general fund is critical to the fiscal situation. And that's because every dollar paid as dividends is a dollar that doesn't wind up in the general fund as revenue. And a dollar missing from general fund revenue is a dollar added to the deficit. Now, to be fair, the opposite's also true. Every dollar that you spend on government services is a dollar that can't be spent on dividends. You can only spend money once. To sum up, the competition between dividends and government services creates a huge fiscal problem for you legislators. We have a surplus without dividends, as you can see, $300 million surplus. If you didn't pay dividends at all, you can also get there just as easily by saying $1.6 billion deficit with $1.9 paid out as dividends. If you didn't make the payments, we would have a surplus. So there are a whole lot of people, including perhaps some legislators, that look at the deficit and say, so what? We've had deficits year after year after year with no apparent ill effects. And why are we suddenly so concerned about deficits? Well, I would say that the fiscal impact of deficits has been hidden by our ability to withdraw money from the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. We started out with $15 billion or so in that. Year after year of deficits has drained it down to about $2 billion. And I fear that many people don't understand that deficits are now a big problem because we live in a different fiscal world. It's a world without reserves. It's a world in which budgets have to balance because you cannot fill them from savings anymore. Now, are we really out of reserves? We talked about the CBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve. It's actually got $2 billion in it. Seems like a lot of money, but in perspective to the rest of the budget, it's just enough to cover a year's worth of dividends. It's not enough to fill a deficit if we didn't have the POMV payout, percent of market value payout. So I suppose we could use the CBR to fill the deficit one more year. If you do that, the CBR can hardly even be used as a shock absorber anymore. And by shock absorber, I mean, let's say you pass a budget, go home, and oil prices fall by $10. It's not out of the realm of possibility to see something like that happening. But what it means is revenue can fall by several hundred million dollars. In most states, they have to come back in special session and say, what are we going to do? And of course, revenues are slow to respond, so they look at this as, what are we going to cut? We got to do it midway in the fiscal year. It's really difficult. You come back and you basically go through your subcommittee process again to find where you can cut a couple hundred million dollars. Well, the CBR allows you to say, we don't have to do that. We're going to fill that deficit without coming back in session. So I think it's a necessary shock absorber given the volatility of our revenue stream. Our revenue stream has become much less volatile with POMV payout. You can see that, in fact, traditional revenue is 2.3. We get more money from the POMV payout than we get from oil. And this $2.9 billion is rock solid. Oil is volatile. We know in advance what the payment will be. It looks back 5 years, looks at the market value of the permanent fund. So it's a known number. 5.25% payout is a known number. We know well before the budget process begins exactly how much revenue we're getting from our biggest source. That makes budgeting a lot easier. Well, it doesn't make budgeting any easier. It gives you a great deal more confidence in your revenue stream. So you can also look at the earnings reserve account as a source of reserves. Both chairs are on record as saying they do not intend to have the ERA, earnings reserve account, go the way of the constitutional budget reserve account. And as I said, That went from $15 billion to $2 billion over the course of about 5 years. So the reasons, I think, well, I don't want to put words in your mouths, co-chairs, but I read your remarks as saying that's another way of saying the earnings reserve account is not available for filling deficits. At least you don't want it to be. And I think your reasons for that are clear, but I'm going to go through them for the public. You know, the chairman know, that draws in excess of the sustainable amount are the equivalent of eating your seed corn. The fewer kernels you have to plant, the lower your harvest. And if you take money beyond the planned draw, then you are reducing your seed corn. You're reducing your principal. What that means is that with a lower market value of the permanent fund, your earnings are lower. Lower earnings means lower dividend payments. Lower earnings, lower balance means lower payout from the POMV. As the payout goes down and your expenditures don't go down, you have larger deficits. Larger deficits mean larger unplanned draws next year to fill those deficits. So this is a death spiral. And I'm glad that you're on record as saying that, because I think that's something that the people of Alaska may not understand. So using the ERA seems like it would take a long time. It actually doesn't. Our model shows that the ERA would be empty by FY28. And of course, the danger of having an empty ERA, I already mentioned. When the earnings reserve is empty, there are no dividends paid, and there is no payout. No payout means that now you suddenly have to come back and figure out how to save $1 billion or $2 billion from the budget. And without sufficient time for revenue to kick in, that pretty much means cutting $2 billion. So back to the point, without reserves, you have only the two standard deficit filling tools, raising revenue or cutting expenditures. Taxes don't appear to be an option. Both the Commissioner of Revenue and the OMB Director said they don't have any immediate intent to raise taxes. So that perhaps leads to an expectation that the February 13th budget is going to cut $1.6 billion in expenditures. Well, now we can go to slide 5, which provides some perspective on how large a $1.6 billion cut is. The slide takes the FY20 budget in blue bars. That is the Walker budget. So that's a starting point. It has a $1.6 billion deficit built in. So if we were going to fill that deficit, and this chart starts filling it by eliminating all general funds in the smallest expenditure item, and you'll notice these are not just agencies along the bottom. They're expenditure items, including permanent fund dividends, the statewide items for debt, retirement, et cetera, and capital. They're all ranked according to size. And if you began to cut at the smallest, you would eliminate the unrestricted general funds in every agency, all the way up, or every item, all the way up to statewide items. Now, when the university students looked at this chart, again, they were a bit shocked, mostly because dividends are huge. They had no idea that dividends took up 37% of our revenue. Let me say that again. we spend 37% of our revenue on dividends. It is the largest expenditure, single expenditure we have, and it far outweighs what we spend on education. Senator Olson asked some of the observations of the class, and I say, well, they were concerned about that, not just the dividends, you know, relatively. So we think dividends are more important than education. And these were the class comments. That, you know, again, I don't want to say all of the things they said because it sounds like, well, I'm willing to give up dividends. Why isn't everybody else? And you know, those are discussions that you can have around here. I don't need to tell you what the options are. But they were certainly surprised at how big dividends are and how tiny the agencies are. And they couldn't understand how we were going to cut $1.6 billion from the budget without cutting over here where the money is. And of course, over here is dividends, education, which means K-12 schools primarily. That's about $1.2 billion of it is K-12. Or here in health and social services, the bulk of which is Medicaid. So, like them, I'm curious to see whether the governor's February 13th budget and the legislature's response to it includes drawing from reserves or shifting costs to local governments or reducing dividends, reducing other services, or revenue, implementing revenue. There isn't much more I can say on these. Again, without getting political, and I'd like to avoid that. But so I hate to end without recommendations or without a conclusion. But the decisions are yours to make, and we simply provide information, not advice. And I hope we can provide you with as much information as you need to help you make the decisions. We do have the model, which I think will help you analyze various policy choices and see their fiscal impacts. And of course, we're always here to help you with the normal analysis, subcommittee work, as you move through the budget process. So I hope you have a short and productive session.
Well, thank you, Mr. Teal, for your presentation, and we'll have you back after the governor has submitted his budget on the 13th, and your department has had time to go ahead and review it, look for items that are potentially excluded that should have been included, or included that should have been excluded, or what have you. And that may take possibly a week or so after the submission. So we'll have you back to brief us on that, along with the OMB director. With that concludes the meeting today. I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Appreciate that. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., bring your smiley faces back to finance again. We're going to talk about Alaska's oil basin with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee, and I think you'll find it very interesting. We'll talk about oil and gas and the trade-offs between them and other issues facing our development of our resources. See you tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We are adjourned.